Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, November 11th, 2021, is 103 years since the Great Slaughter ended at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of the 18th year of the 20th century, second millennium, Anno Domini. By the time World War I ended on that venerable day, the empires and societies of pre-war Europe had vanished or were disrupted beyond recognition. The war to end wars was the beginning of the final triumph of the Industrial Revolution. Flesh yielded to steel. The shells that fell upon its soldiers like rain for 4 years, 3 months, and 1 week made mockeries of courage, fear, and sacrifice, pummeled them into bloody particles and blotches. Whom the shells missed, the machine guns harvested. No other war was as atrocious to its soldiers, except perhaps the American Civil War half a century earlier. In each, the infantry was charged en masse into sure death, and the battlefields of both wars were littered with the corpses of thousands, many thousands more lost limbs and or sanity. Rapid advances in weaponry were not matched in either war by changes in tactics. Civil War leaders charged their troops into mass formations of riflemen and artillery. World War I generals sent their soldiers against barbed wire and machine guns. The paralyzing trench warfare of the latter war was a desperate innovation of the former. The short, miserable life of soldiers was never more grim than the stagnant war of attrition fought on the Western Front of Europe from late 1914, when the summer's initial war of movement settled into trench warfare until the armistice 4 years later. More than 20 million were counted dead, the majority of them soldiers. The next war, a generation later, would decimate many times more civilians than combatants as a result of technological improvements in artillery, long-range aerial bombing, and the development of nuclear power. World War I was a short-range war. Artillery and airplanes were not able to kill at long range as they later were. Soldiers were the main targets and were ceaselessly under attack by artillery barrages that lasted for days and were bombed and machine gunned from the air. Poisoned gas and infantry-fired machine guns were primarily aimed by soldiers at soldiers, unable to escape them. The poor unknowns, and that's a quote from that time, whose deaths prematurely consumed an entire generation of European men and hundreds of thousands of colonial troops from Asia and Africa were slaughtered, plus thousands more from Australia, New Zealand, and North America. It was a soldiers' war, perhaps the last one in which soldiers did most of the killing and dying. The English soldier Wilfred Owen, considered World War I's best soldier poet, was killed just before the war ended. Who are these purgatorial shadows, he wrote of badly wounded soldiers, bearing teeth that leer like skulls, teeth wicked, stroke on stroke of pain. But what slow panic gouged these chasms round their fretted sockets, and from their hair, and through their hands' palms, misery swelters. Surely we have perished, sleeping, and walking hell. But who these hellish? With them in hell, Owen wrote in another poem, the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell. A French soldier who fought at Verdun wrote, "We all had on us the stench of bodies, the bread we ate, the stagnant water we drank, everything we touched had a rotten smell owing to the fact that the earth around us was literally stuffed with corpses." Arthur Graham wrote in a poem, "And everywhere the dead, only the dead were always present, present as a vile, sickly smell of rottenness, infecting earth and air." John Ellis wrote in his book, High Deep in Hell, Trench Warfare in World War I, that the Western Front that encompassed a slash of trenches from the English Channel to Switzerland should be remembered as, quote, "an unparalleled nightmare of filth, decay, noise, blood, and death, in which men fought for reasons they hardly understood, for a future they almost ceased to believe in, and offered nothing when it came." The soldiers of World War I, British war correspondent Philip Gibbs said, lived in a world which is as different from this known world of ours as though they belonged to another race of men inhabiting another planet. Eric Maria Remarque, author of All Quiet on the Western Front, perhaps the best ever about war, wrote in his second book, The Road Back, a question by the father of a returning German soldier after the armistice. "Now, tell us of your experiences." "Experiences," I repeat, and think to myself, "I haven't experienced anything. It was just war all the time. How should a man have experiences there?" American poet Ezra Pound, who later succumbed to a pro-fascist meltdown, wrote an epitaph for the soldiers of World War I in refute of, quote, "misty-eyed sentimentality," unquote, that characterized popular commemoration of Armistice Day, observed for a time as Remembrance Day. "Died some pro patria, non dulce, non et decor. Walked high deep in hell, believing in old men's lies, then unbelieving. Came home, home to a lie, home to many deceits, home to old lies and new infamy." And that was Ezra Pound. Armistice is defined as a temporary truce, but to the American president, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, the 1918 armistice was to be an end to war forever. He died a few years later, miserably aware his 14 points for world peace and his plans for a League of Nations to ensure that peace had failed and that small wars were even then erupting all over the planet. Hundreds of millions had prayed for his success, paradoxically engrossed in a worldwide influenza epidemic that killed perhaps five times as many as had World War I, itself a breeding ground for the pandemic. Armistice Day became a symbol of peace to the world's ordinary people who suffer horribly during times of war and plague. Each Armistice Day, a full minute of silence was observed at the 11th hour all over the world in memory of the fallen. By the time German armies invaded Poland on September 1, 1939, millions who had hoped for peace were already dead from wars, mass executions and murders, various pogroms. Nearly 60 million more died in the following 6 years of World War II. All who survived World War I are dead, joining their comrades who died in the trenches and on the wire. The World War II generation, so young in the countless replay of 1940s war movies, are at the vanishing point, as are Korean War veterans at their backs. Vietnam veterans are soon to be the elders of American 20th century wars. newer generations endure newer wars, as though the litany of horror human beings perpetrate upon each other will never end short of nuclear holocaust. Armistice Day in the USA is now devoted to veterans as superior citizens for their service to the state, rather than as a eulogy to war's cost, trivialized more or less as an effort to recruit newer offerings to Mars. And that was something that I wrote. Armistice 103. And now, by Portland writer Rick Rubin. Veterans of America, I salute you. Annually, on November 11th, it is our duty as patriotic citizens to honor American veterans of all our wars. The brave men and women, whether clerk typists in Korea or expert infantrymen in Kansas, who have actually or potentially defended our American way of life. Personally, I feel this day is one of the more significant of our American holidays, and each year I try to pause and remember one or more specific groups of veterans. I say specific because there are more than 25 million veterans in the country who, together with their immediate families, make up two-fifths of the population. You can't salute them all at once. A person needs something more concrete. For example, one group I delight in honoring is the veterans of the 25th U.S. Infantry Regiment, colored, six of whom had won the Medal of Honor in the Philippines. On August 3rd of that year, a dozen or so members of this organization, angered by the treatment they had received from the white citizens of nearby Brownsville, Texas, made what has been described, by white people at least, as a shooting sortie into the town, killing one citizen. Whether any man of the 25th Regiment had ever been killed by the citizens of Brownsville, I can't say, but I am reasonably certain that no one had ever been convicted of doing so. The soldiers returned to their post unobserved, and during the subsequent official investigation, not one of the 160 men of the three colored companies would inform on his fellow soldiers. On November 5th, President Theodore Roosevelt discharged, without honor, quote unquote, every man of the three companies, observing that if no one admitted guilt, all of them would have to pay the penalty. The discharge without honor meant all pensions and payments were forfeited, including those of the six Medal of Honor winners, and none of the men was ever reinstated or given a pension. And so, each year, I salute the veterans of Brownsville. Would it seem so unsophisticated if I salute the first Americans to die under Hitler's bullets, to be blown to heroes' graves by Mussolini's airplanes? American veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of the Spanish Civil War, I salute you on Veterans Day. I salute those other unlucky veterans, communists and socialists, German-American Bundists, the homosexuals and psychotics, and other disreputable types who were drafted into the army in time of war and were then, though not actually convicted of any crime, discharged under circumstances less than honorable to hunt for jobs as best they knew how. I salute the veterans of Coxey's Army, who in 1894 marched on Washington, D.C. to petition for relief legislation and bonuses for veterans, but were instead rushed by guards, shot and injured, and saw their leaders arrested for the crime of trampling on the grass. And I do not forget to honor the World War I Veterans Bonus Army Marchers of 1932. Several policemen were injured while evicting them from vacant government buildings where they were living, and in the process killed two of their number. The Army was called in by President Herbert Hoover and led by General Douglas MacArthur, advanced in full battle dress with machine guns, tanks, tear gas, drawn sabers, and fixed bayonets. General MacArthur observed the marchers were, quote, animated by the essence of revolution, and further commented that President Hoover had let it go another week, I believe the institutions of our government would have been severely threatened. And that was a quote from Douglas MacArthur. So to be fair, I salute not only the Bonus Army of 1932, but also the soldiers who attacked them and subsequently became veterans themselves. And further, I salute veteran General MacArthur. I salute the Negro combat troops of World War I, who served with French divisions overseas so as not to cause trouble and won many citations for bravery under fire. Perhaps the only veterans of our history who not only had to learn foreign weapons and foreign military organization, but even a foreign language just to serve their own army in time of war. And I further salute some who returned home from World War I and were among the 70 Negroes, several still in uniform, who were lynched during the first post-war year. Even if they had learned uppity ways from those alien Frenchmen, they were American veterans nonetheless. Of course, the first veterans I hail each year are my own comrades in arms of the Korean police action, quote unquote, who, if they were less than totally successful as soldiers, were less successful still at draft dodging, although many, no doubt, now march in the parades of November 11th. Then I move on to other defenders of the American dream, the NICI members of the 442nd Infantry Regiment and the 100th Battalion, who voluntarily joined the Army out of concentration camps across California, Idaho, and Utah, won 5 distinguished unit citations with the 5th Army in Italy and the 7th Army in the Rhineland, and are said to be the most decorated regimental combat team in American history. Then they returned home to such places as Hood River, Oregon, to find the American Legion did not want a bunch of lousy Japs repossessing their lawful homes and farms. The government they had served voluntarily and well was prepared to pay depreciated 1945 prices for their cars, equipment, and other possessions confiscated in 1942. I salute the American Legionnaires who castrated, hanged, then shot full of holes one Wesley Everest from a railroad bridge near Centralia, Washington, on Armistice Day, 1919, and thereby defended the American way of life against the 8-hour day and other such foreign-inspired wobbly IWW demands. I salute sharp-eyed American Legionnaire Homer Chaliot, who reviewed a Legion pamphlet titled Americanism, What Is It? Legionnaire Chaliot found the pamphlet contained too much emphasis on freedom of speech and too little on the fundamentals of religion. In addition, the paper was made in Japan, and the American eagle on the cover was printed in red. He forced the pamphlet, clearly un-American, to be withdrawn. I salute the Military Order of the World War, a former group of World War I officers who, in their national bulletin, reported that the American Civil Liberties Union actually, quote, believes in rampant free speech, unquote. I salute as well a man who, as colonel, shared with Ethan Allen leadership of the expedition that captured Fort Ticonderoga in 1775, who later that year led the capture of the fort at St. John's, and in 1776 almost captured Quebec, who attacked the British on Lake Champlain with a fleet of leaky small boats, and in 1777 repulsed an attempted invasion of Connecticut, who was wounded in the thick of fighting at Saratoga while leading his troops to victory, who commanded Philadelphia in 1778, West Point in 1780, and went on to become one of America's best-known veterans. Colonel Benedict Arnold, I salute you. I hail, Private Edward Donald Slovak, called Eddie, one of thousands of American soldiers convicted of deserting in the face of the enemy during World War II, but the only one since 1864 to be executed for doing so. On January 31, 1945, he was shot to death by a firing squad and rushed into veterandom. I salute Colonel Charles R. Forbes, commander of the Veterans Bureau under President Warren Harding, who, after Harding's death, was found to have operated a gigantic swindle which milked the Bureau of more than $200 million in less than 2 years. At a time when disabled veterans in hospitals lacked bandages, bedding, and drugs, Colonel Forbes condemned carloads of these items and sold them off a fraction at their cost. I salute, too, the veterans of U.S. military actions other than declared wars, Hawaii 1893, China 1900, Panama 1903, Dominican Republic 1904, Nicaragua 1911, Haiti 1915, Mexico 1916, Dominican Republic 1916, who got just as dead, wounded, just as painfully, but by some oversight, got no GI Bill, no homecoming parade, no veteran special bonuses, or even so much as a casualty statistic in the World Almanac. I salute the men who fought to destroy the dictatorship in Cuba, the anti-Batista fighters, now no more able to get a good job than those earlier anti-fascists, the men of the American Lincoln Brigade. I salute the Bay of Pigs invaders, who, if they weren't either Americans or in the American Army, at least took our pay and did our work, however unsuccessfully. I salute the former officers and men of the Revolutionary War who participated in Captain Daniel Shea's Rebellion of 1786, an attempt to overthrow the government of Massachusetts. I salute the members of an alleged special group that is supposed to have spent World War II high up in Colorado, having been adjudged by the Army as too subversive to be of any use, but not subversive enough to kill or kick out or not draft in the first place. I salute veterans of the Revolution who knew it was right and proper for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. And I salute the men of the Union Army in the Civil War who knew that it was wrong and unlawful for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. I salute American veterans who invaded Latin American countries to protect them from outside intervention, then invaded again to intervene on behalf of American property rights. In fact, I stand ready to salute any group or individual veteran who fits my peculiarly warped view of defenders of the American dream. I salute those first Americans to die for their country, the American Indians. I salute those pilgrims, Puritans, and Protestants who killed them and were killed by them, and thus became the second Americans to die for their country. I salute the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women in Vietnam who died for some country. I am not quite sure whose. Nor do I slight the American boys in the Congo, in Korea, in Formosa, Spain, and Morocco, nor the military advisory groups in dozens or perhaps even hundreds of other countries, all dying or at least ready to die without benefit of declared war or GI Bill of Rights in defense of freedom and the local USIS library. Veterans of America, myself included, I salute you. And that was by Rick Rubin. Veterans of America, I salute you. Rick Rubin, when he wrote this, was a Portland artist and writer, and this article was among the best of the realist, printed by Running Press of Philadelphia, and was originally published in Realist 71, November 1966. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser-Schalk is this program's engineer. I end this program with a poem by Siegfried Sassoon, who, despite his Teutonic name, was a British soldier of World War I. On passing the new Menin Gate. Who will remember passing through this gate, the unheroic dead who fed the guns? Who shall absolve the foulness of their fate, those doomed, conscripted, and victorious ones? Crudely renewed, the salient holds its own. Paid are its dim defenders by this bomb. Paid with a pile of peace-complacent stone, the armies who endured that sullen swamp. Here was the world's worst wound, and here with pride their name liveth forever. The gateway claims, was ever an immolation so belied as these intolerably nameless names? Well might the dead who struggled in the slime rise and deride this sepulcher of crime. And that was by Siegfried Sassoon. Happy Armistice Day and the U.S. Marine Corps 246th birthday yesterday, November 10th, 1775.